this is an attempt to create something new, to allow for the possibility of other forms of struggle to develop and to permit the creation of a space where the people of Mexico can begin to define and imagine what kind of a Mexico they really want to live in.
Bueno, pues estamos en la lucha también de los pueblos por la dignidad de nuestros pueblos.
Well, we are also in the struggle for our people. It has been 500 years now that the strength of the indigenous people has been sleeping. Now, the voice of indigenous women is going to be heard.
Hello, I'm Craig Benjamin. This documentary is about divisions among people, divisions of nationality and citizenship, hierarchies of gender and ethnicity, divisions of power, wealth, and privilege, and about how some of these divisions can perhaps be overcome as women and men around the world realize that they face a common threat in the form of the impoverishment, uprooting, and political repression that are part and parcel of free trade and economic globalization. Over the next half hour, we'll hear voices from the Mexican Coyuntura, the coming together of diverse sectors of society, catalyzed by the negotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement and the indigenous people and peasant uprising in Chiapas, Mexico. We'll also hear from the solidarity movements which are making room in the struggle for land and liberty in Mexico and the struggle for economic and social justice in Canada and the United States. This half-hour program was produced in collaboration with the Mexico Solidarity Network. It's titled Becoming a Fighter. On January 1st, 1994, the day the North American Free Trade Agreement came into effect, a previously unknown guerrilla army made up primarily of indigenous women and men took over five municipalities on the edge of the Lacandon rainforest in southern Mexico. The roots of the Zapatista uprising lie in the conditions of life for indigenous peoples in Chiapas, a region which produces enormous wealth, but which is marked by some of the worst extremes of impoverishment, landlessness, and political repression in all of Mexico. But if the uprising has emerged from the soils of Chiapas, the Zapatistas have made it clear that their cause is larger than any one state, larger indeed than Mexico itself. In a series of letters and declarations released to the press since the uprising began, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation has denounced not only the political and economic elite which had ruled Mexico for much of this century, but also the rule of the marketplace, which this elite has imposed on Mexico, up to and including the negotiation of continental free trade. NAFTA, the Zapatistas have said, is a death sentence for indigenous peoples, but not for indigenous peoples alone. And the struggle for social and economic justice must involve not only the indigenous peoples of Chiapas, but a coming together of everyone who has experienced or who fears impoverishment and dispossession. Zapatista statements refer to single mothers, to gays and lesbians, to people of color, to religious minorities, to the unemployed, to the working poor. In the Zapatistas' words, the majority disguised as the untolerated minority. The Zapatista uprising is extraordinary for this effort to reach out to so many sectors of the population and to make connections among so many forms of oppression. But what is perhaps even more significant is the response to the Zapatista uprising on the part of much of the Mexican population and of people throughout the continent. For 12 days after the Zapatista uprising, the Mexican government bombarded villages in Chiapas. The Zapatistas slipped back to the rainforest and the mountains where they continued to exhort the people of Mexico to take a stand. And in cities throughout Mexico, and indeed throughout North America, people took to the streets to demand that the Mexican government recognize the legitimacy of the Zapatista struggle and sit down with them to discuss the terms for peace. Just as the Zapatistas had envisioned, people from all sectors of the urban and rural poor declared, We are all Zapatistas. After 12 days, the Mexican government finally called off the assault and entered into peace talks with the insurgents. Then in February 1995, with the peace talks still unresolved and pressure mounting from foreign banks and other investors anxious to get back to business as usual, the Mexican government launched a second full-scale military assault on the Zapatistas. The Mexican government said it was going to arrest the Zapatista leaders, including the spokespersons known only as Marcos and Ramona. But throughout Mexico, hundreds of thousands of protesters declared, "We are all Marcos, we are all Ramona." Once again, the Mexican government called off the assault and resumed negotiations. Salvador Peniche is a Mexican social worker and an activist with the Mexican Action Network Against Free Trade.
Well, I think that what the Zapatistas have done already is has changed dramatically the country. Even if the process stopped today, like if we could just stop the story and just do whatever, like go on from what it's been gained, it's already a new country. So we have new institutions, new mechanisms, new political atmosphere, and it all depends on the political struggle.
Of course, popular protest in Mexico did not begin with the Zapatistas. The process of economic restructuring is more than two decades old in Mexico. And as this restructuring has deepened, a new spirit of militancy has swept Mexico's social and labor movements. Diverse movements of the urban poor and the rural poor were also beginning to find common ground in opposition to government cutbacks, electoral fraud, and the selling off of the country's wealth to international banks and other transnational corporations. But the dramatic uprising in Chiapas gave this coyuntura a focus and demonstrated to the people of Mexico the strength of their own power. What is extraordinary about these developments is that the coming together of popular movements in support of the Zapatista uprising depends on diverse sectors of the population being able to identify with the indigenous insurgents of Chiapas, despite the fact that historically, indigenous peoples in Mexico are the most marginalized, most often ignored social group, even within progressive movements.
Well, I think one of the most important teachings of the Zapatista affair is that it showed indeed not only to the outside but only to also to Mexicans the terrible conditions of the indigenous people in our country. I'm really really concerned about this thing because, you know, Mexican, even progressive Mexican sectors were not aware or didn't do any concrete things in order to change the situation. In fact, I would say that the Mexican society, is all sectors of Mexican society have a little bit of, you know, responsibility of the situation that happened. So the Zapatistas in that sense are a step forward, everybody, like saying, okay, what we want is respect to our rights, and let's work together, all Mexicans, in a civilized way, to have this way, this means the democratic country, so we can change this injustice that happened in the indigenous population.
Mexican political life is marked by sharp inequalities in power and in privilege. Inequalities between urban workers and the rural poor, between landlords and tenant farmers, between indigenous peoples and Ladinos, between corrupt leaders and their own communities, between women and men. It's the manipulation of these inequalities which has kept the political and economic elite in power. Margarita Gutierrez Romero is an indigenous woman from Hidalgo province in Mexico who has taken part in protests in support of the Zapatistas, as well as in a longer history of organizing in her community.
Es un poco difícil porque, como decíamos, a veces esas maneras de conquista, de, o sea, estamos tan contaminados ya. Yo no sé, puedo hablar de una pureza.
Because of the waves of conquest, we are contaminated now. We have within Mexico people who have learned the model of conquering, the model of subordinating, and they take advantage of this knowledge by exploiting everybody else. It's a terrible struggle. For example, take my sandals. In Canada, in other countries, people can wear sandals. But here, when indigenous people wear our sandals, we are looked down upon. Here, there are winners and losers. It's a competition.
Hay conflictos, por eso es que hay problemas, porque no hay sensibilidad, no hay como que aquí hay ganadores y perdedores, y a ver, es una competencia, ¿no?
The sharp divisions within Mexican society leave many communities vulnerable to repression when the Mexican government strikes back against protesters. Suzanne Rumsey is Associate Director of the Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America. She was part of the first international observer team to enter the combat zone in Chiapas after the Mexican government relaxed travel restrictions on January 12, 1994.
Well, when you talk about southern Mexico, and particularly southern rural Mexico, you're really talking about two different worlds. There's the indigenous community, and in Chiapas that's 60-70% of the population, and then the non-indigenous or Ladino community, and they really are two worlds apart. The levels of poverty, of illiteracy, of poor health are comparable to what you would find, say, in rural Guatemala, which contrasts with a fairly comfortable non-indigenous community. So really, not only in terms of the location of where they live, but a real sense of two worlds existing side by side in southern Mexico. I think perhaps one of the testimonies we took that really highlighted for me these disparities was meeting a young Tzeltal indigenous woman. She was 18 years old and had been in the hospital in Ocosingo recovering from a cesarean section. She'd lost the baby during the surgery. She had come in from an outlying community and had been accompanied by her husband and brother-in-law because she spoke no Spanish. And the military, when they came into the town, took away her brother and or her brother-in-law and her husband, along with what we were able to identify as a third indigenous man, and disappeared them. And she and everyone else in the hospital, as I just mentioned, was kicked out, and she was found on the street by a local person with nothing more than her hospital gown on, and just completely lost. I mean, she couldn't communicate. She was sick, and just completely distraught because her husband and brother-in-law were gone. And so when we asked her, well, were you able to get, this was a week later, were you able to get any help from the local authorities to locate your husband and brother-in-law? She said, of course not, I don't speak Spanish. So just a real sense of the complete marginalization that indigenous people and indigenous women feel in that society. They're strangers in their own land.
The Zapatistas clearly recognize the marginalization and vulnerability of their communities. They have said that they are not afraid to die in their struggle and have called themselves the dead of all time, dying once again. But the Zapatistas also point out that their strength in indigenous people's 500-year history of resistance to exploitation and oppression. Cecilia Rodriguez of the Texas-based National Commission for Democracy in Mexico helps maintain communication between the Zapatistas and the public in the United States. Because of her work, she knows the vulnerability of the marginalized in Mexico. In 1995, in Chiapas, she was assaulted and raped by armed men she believes were acting on behalf of the landlords or the military. Cecilia Rodriguez uses this attempt to intimidate and silence her to illustrate the low-intensity warfare which indigenous and campesino women face every day in Chiapas. But Cecilia Rodriguez also sees the strength in indigenous people's history of resistance. And she says, as more and more Mexicans experience eviction from the land, loss of their jobs, rising costs of living, and declining social welfare services, she says they too are beginning to see the value in indigenous people's history of resistance to the contemporary political and economic order.
I think it's because the indigenous people, because of the way in which the community is organized, are a direct contradiction to quote modern industrial society. They've always been it. So for 500 years, I think there's been a systematic chopping away and elimination of cultures. The indigenous people, I think, also have a relationship to the resources of the earth. In Mexico, for example, it's their livelihood, you know, but it's also a very different mode of production that is considered, quote, inefficient. and irrelevant and outdated and outmoded, etc., 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 because what's the preferred mode is these huge agri-industrial, I mean, it's almost like an industrial agriculture or something where you mass produce food and you mass produce, you know, things for human consumption. And I think for all those reasons that the indigenous people, in addition, are always feel the most brutal point of this so-called globalization. It's almost like they can't avoid getting out, because they've never left that position, you know, they've always been there. So this response is like an elemental response from our guts, I think, as human beings, you know, that we're losing our ability to survive as human beings, that if we allow this kind of corporate nightmare to continue to evolve and not question it and not fight to exert our humanity within it, there's not going to be, you know, there's going to be less and less cultures, less and less peoples, less and less differentiations. I don't think that that's, you know, I'm not trying to give an apocalyptic view, because I believe that human beings, that's the essence of their humanity, is their aspiration for freedom. You know, and we can either take it personally and say, you know, I'm a Zapatista too, because I believe all human beings should have dignity and jobs and health and housing, you know, or I'm not. So, yeah, I think that is the way in which the role of the indigenous people has evolved and now is a primary ascendance, you know, in this particular moment in history.
For more than 60 years, the Mexican state had operated through an elaborate patronage system. Village heads who cooperated with the government might receive a share of development funds. Peasant organizations that avoided confrontations with landlords were occasionally awarded land or credit. Urban workers who belonged to the state-controlled union would receive relatively good wages and job security in a state-controlled industry. What the political and economic elite of Mexico asked in return is that the ruling party be brought back to office election after election. The divisions within Mexican society of ethnicity, gender, and occupation were also the channels through which patronage and votes flowed. But today, after two decades of economic restructuring leading up to the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Mexican government has little to offer most people. Under the sway of Reaganomics or neoliberalism, the Mexican government has begun selling off state industries and drastically cutting the civil service. In preparation for the implementation of NAFTA, the ruling party amended the Constitution to eliminate legal protection for communal lands, effectively ending land reform. And with most export earnings being paid to the international banks which control the government's debt, little wealth remains in Mexico to be redistributed in the form of community development projects. What the new Mexican economy does offer is a proliferation of low-wage, short-term, and insecure jobs in the export assembly plants and in the service sector, jobs which so far have largely been filled by women. It's a phenomenon which is not limited to Mexico. Cecilia Rodriguez says she's seen precisely the same process taking place on the U.S.-Mexico border, where she worked for 10 years with garment workers in El Paso. And the same process is taking shape in cities throughout Canada and the U.S. Cecilia Rodriguez says it's no coincidence, then, that women have played such a prominent role, not only in the Zapatista uprising, but also in the solidarity efforts within Mexico and throughout North America. Just as indigenous women and men are at the center of the struggle to preserve life on the land, working class women, indigenous and non-indigenous alike, are at the center of a global struggle to maintain family and community in the face of a dramatic restructuring of social services and wage labor.
The Zapatistas have, for example, their 16 points of what they're struggling for. The women garment workers in El Paso had 7, and they were 7 of the same things that the Zapatistas had, because it's the need of poor people. It's the need of people who are powerless, who are disenfranchised, who don't have a voice, who don't even have the basic human necessities. So there was a very strong strong link. And I think the women Zapatistas are a reflection of a global reality. And even if you look in this room of these committees who are doing work for the Zapatistas in the U.S., the majority of them are women, and the more, the clearer, the more determined, and the more intense responses are from women, because we're also faceless ones, you know. We're also people who, because of our gender and our particular role in the community, don't have a voice and don't have a face and don't have a a right to exert our influence and our humanity within the larger context. And so, yeah, I think it's not just singular to the Zapatistas. I think they kind of are a manifestation of the emerging and increasingly strong role of women in liberation struggles in general.
Throughout this documentary, I've emphasized the victories of solidarity movements over the Mexican government and its backers. But if the popular protests have twice forced the Mexican government to call off a full-scale assault on the Zapatistas, they have not prevented the continuation of a low-intensity war against the indigenous population of Chiapas, nor have they prevented the Mexican government preparing for a new assault. In 1995, there was one soldier for every three residents in the conflict zone. In just 6 months, human rights organizations recorded 23 people killed, 27 disappeared, 5 women raped, and 47 people jailed, and 743 people illegally detained. Clearly, one challenge for solidarity work is to maintain a close watch on Chiapas and intense pressure on the Mexican government, not only at the times of crisis, but during the long periods between crises as well. Yolanda Hernandez Esteban is an indigenous woman and a teacher from Hidalgo State.
Bueno, pues yo lo que le digo al pueblo de Canadá es que pues los saludamos, mandamos saludos fraternales de aquí de mi país y que bueno, que esperamos pues su comprensión, su apoyo solidario a nuestros pueblos que se encuentran ahorita.
To Canada, we send a warm hello to you from here in my country. And we hope, well, for your understanding, for your support, your solidarity, for our people, our communities in struggle, in particular in Chiapas. I hope you are in permanent communication with Chiapas so that you know the reality of the events there, because our government doesn't let out to the press all that is happening here, so the world doesn't know very well. We hope that Canadians can be here periodically to know for yourselves the reality of what is taking place in Chiapas. I worry about Chiapas because it has been bombarded so much, and not just the Zapatista army has been bombarded, but the people too. So many people have fallen. And so I'll just say thanks now to you in my language, Camari.
Que hago es saludarlos y en mi lengua indígena les digo gracias, Camari.
Cecilia Rodriguez also points to the importance of long-term organizing. She is working to help U.S. residents understand what is happening in Chiapas and to become active in support of the Zapatistas. But she also points to the underlying processes of globalization and economic restructuring that are impacting on communities everywhere. Whether or not they are members of Zapatista support groups, she says that women and men who take a stand for social and economic justice are involved in a common struggle with the Zapatistas.
In Spanish, there's a word called un luchador, a fighter, to become a fighter. And that doesn't mean to take up arms. I think to become a fighter means to, in whatever way, in whatever means is most comfortable and most clear to us, to, as I stated before, exert our humanity and fight for a world where there is justice. And the way that the dominant system defines it, it defines it as kind of an aberration. You know, oh, you're one of those idealists, or oh, you're one of those purists, or oh, you're one of those hippie fanatics, or I mean, they have all kinds of labels for what I think is a very human vocation. And just like we perceive our responsibility to our families, to our education, we have to perceive our responsibility to our community. You know, what kind of waste do they put in the ground, and how does that affect us? What kind of waste do they put in the air? How do the police treat our young people? What kind of education do our young people get? And what kind of education do poor people's young people get? That we have to care about that, because it's all connected. And I think that's, in the broadest sense of the word, if someone becomes a fighter, you know, for that kind of a world, then they're automatically a Zapatista. Of course, you know, we'd like to ask them to organize committees that support the Zapatistas specifically. You know, that's where we are. But I think that that's actually the path that we have to begin to try to identify, you know, is how do we shift this really negative, ugly kind of vision of fear and of power mongering that's being promoted by, you know, by some of the leaders of the government, and this emptiness that's being promoted by the mass media, you know, where your concept of freedom, like I said in some speech the other night, is that you have a right to choose between Coke and Pepsi. I don't think that that's freedom, and I don't think that democracy is, you know, is just limited to the right to vote. I don't think that's democracy, and I think we're passive. And we lose our humanity when we don't look beyond that, and we don't look for the best that's in us. And I believe there's a lot of good in us.
My name is Craig Benjamin. This program was translated by Sheila Wilmot. The translation was read by Sheila Wilmot and Cindy Duffy. Music for this program is from the album Somos Indios, a compilation of Mexican songs dedicated to the Zapatistas. Somos Indios was produced by Tenoch Disc Records. Their address is Post Office Box 906, Austin, Texas. 78767. That's Box 906, Austin, Texas. 78767. For information about the Zapatista Uprising, contact the National Commission for Democracy in Mexico. Their address is 601 North Cotton Street, number A103, El Paso, Texas, 79902. That's the National Commission for Democracy in Mexico. 601 North Cotton Street, number A103, El Paso, Texas, 79902. This program is part of the Cassette Culture Catalog. For more information about this program or other programs in our catalog, you can write to us at Box 4927, Station E, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, K1S 5J1. For their support in the production and the distribution of this program, I would like to thank CFRU-FM in Guelph, Vancouver Radio Co-op, Local 5121 of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union, and the Mexico Solidarity Network.